Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world. You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday.
Honey, honey, love's like a superstar. has a funny word, lies rolling forward at the mind's rebirth. Desperation is a friend at hand, the reach for touch in this arid land. Oh, but you know what you do, yeah, you and your dancing shoes. Oh, you so good at writing tomorrow, you do anything you want to. Desperation is the things we miss. It's the asteroid, it's a final kiss. Desperation is a disconnect. The war inside for some self-respect. But you are so beautiful, why? Yeah, you and your dancing shoes. Oh, you so good at being desire. You do anything you want to. My sanctuary, the empire state to my sanity. Desperation is a counter strike against the giants and the rats alike. Oh, but you go clean of the shadows, yeah, you and your dancing shoes. Oh, you so good at writing tomorrow. Would you take me with you?
Right there were the sounds of Paolo Nutini with the song Desperation. Before that, a little bit of Jamiroquai with a little bit of Love Philosophy. And yes, welcoming you to my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station. This primarily where you'll be in my company from 5 a.m. up and until 7 a.m. And I don't know, guys. It's doing a little bit of a weather talk just before we actually start the program. Things have been slightly erratic, specifically with the weather this past particular week. Ultimately, sort of like giving an indication of, you know, where we find ourselves. Now, the downside has been obviously that the biggest talking points of the whole of this June, July has been how, you know, how extremely hot it has been for the Northern Hemisphere, specifically with Spain and France ultimately suffering the wildfires that they're suffering today. Canada suffering the wildfire that it had been suffering up and until the World Cup final, as well as also the, you know, record temperatures that they recorded during the period of these particular 2 month scenario. And it has been indicators primarily to the rest of the world to try and understand, okay, you know, see primarily what is going on. But obviously the major talking point for the rest of the world has been the block plus block equals unblock ridiculous scenario happening there in the Middle East, which I still till today don't know what is actually what. Really, guys, I've been trying to stay abreast and specifically on top of the, you know, potential peaceful, to say peaceful is a bit of also of a misaligned term, but rather to see whether or not the parties that be technically will meet some sort of a middle ground to agree upon. The discussion obviously speaks towards whether or not we will actually see any particular stability for the rest of this year, any particular peaceful resolution for the rest of this year, any particular truce, treaty, peace agreement, you name it, for the rest of this particular year. Chances are zero. In between, if you have not heard, the interviews specifically for Antonio Guterres's position has also now commenced, because it has actually started on Friday or Thursday. And that is now a whole new dimension stepping in, because one of the countries obviously that has a veto on who can be appointed is America. They are in that particular cluster. But enough of the particular roundup. Specifically, we here on the My Sunday Morning Take, we technically take a completely different direction, looking at anything history, anything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, in order for us to get to, understand the subject matter at hand. And from this morning's subject matter at hand technically has a little bit of an appeal associated to it, but also a broader kind of a warning outlined in it. Now, I'll start with a little bit of a story behind this morning's particular subject matter, which technically looks at, the future of scientific research in terms of, would humanity be able to discover anything new going ahead? And I'm not citing in the particular sort of like educational background development scenario. No, I'm taking this starting from a particular discussion that I viewed and watched back on Friday in preparation technically for this morning's discussion. Back on Friday, I watched a video of the world famous astrophysicist, Mr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He had been famous. He's similar to like the British, the other British physicist, Brian Cox. Not Brian Cox, the South African actor, who's technically Scottish. But Brian Cox, the astrophysicist who also has various particular documentaries and the likes, and is also, known for being a slightly more public speaker across the world, specifically on promoting the goods of science and scientific research and all that particular aspects. Now, deGrasse Tyson, in his, because it's his YouTube channel known as Star Talk, he had a specific appeal. The appeal was how the American society should reclaim back its prominent role, specifically in discovering, in making new discoveries in the realm of scientific research. And he had a very good point, because there was a very long time that the American Scientific Research Society was at the forefront of bringing us all the technologies that we look at and we interact with today into reality. He gave an example of a gentleman back in the 1920s who was trying to understand how particles would interact in space. And this gentleman basically looked at the particles in his own particular sort of like research lab and discovered particles primarily that led to a development of the medical machine, the MRI. MRI's full name stands for the MRI scan is known as a magnetic resonance imaging machine. Now, the magnetic resonance imaging machine actually has a word missing from the front of it, because It is known as potentially being one of the most important scanning machines in medical science, because primarily it allows the doctors to see the flesh, not the bone, because in some cases you do one scan for bones to see whether or not, you know, any bones are broken or if there are issues with some bones, and another scan which is for the soft bits of you, you know, in your body. Now, the MRI has a word missing, like I told you, which technically should become at the start of the word. Like I said, its full name is the medical resonance imaging, but its full name should be the nuclear medical resonance imaging, which is, if you guys remember back to the discussion that Helmut and I had here on the home run, is one of the particular key things specifically that, you know, there's a presence of a lot of nuclear technology in the medical field as well, specifically in scanning, scanning patients and understanding the ailments that they suffer from. Now, as we obviously look at this perspective or this particular indicator, as this morning's discussion is based upon, you know, the importance of scientific research, deGrasse Tyson cited that back in the 1950s and the early part of the 20th century, his appeal was to fellow Americans, basically. But I also understood his appeal primarily in that if you are a government policymaker, a legislator a lawmaker in your local lawmakers institution like the parliament and the likes, do not look down on scientific research as something that is a waste of space. One key particular difference between that has been a recent social media post that I saw about, he's a comedian, this guy. He's a comedian, but he's technically an engineer. And he cited primarily that, you know, if for engineers, the role for engineers is that they are the guys that have to fix quick things very quickly, make sure that it's not too messy or too dirty, but they have to do the dirty work anyway, and that they have to provide said solutions. But if you wish to understand how the difference between a scientist and a engineer is that a scientist would be working on a problem for 10 years and then they win a Nobel Peace Prize. And for an engineer, you can't be working on a problem for 10 years because you might be fired after week one if you don't have the solution. So that was the difference that this gentleman highlighted. Now, the deGrasse Tyson's particular premise was also that there has been this greater emphasis on the engineering side of things, primarily to see that, okay, so the engineers are scientific enough. We need more people who are solution bringers or solution developers or solution providers, i.e. the engineers, and let's empower and embolden the engineering dimensions. Now, I have to be honest, I thought that the engineers in many cases were also part of the scientific development and the research scenarios of life, just to realize engineers are probably like a few steps behind the scientists, where the engineers have to work actually on projects that provide solutions. The engineers rely on the scientific research that the scientists had developed. And without the research and the knowledge that the scientists had developed, the engineers technically would be going in blind in many scenarios, and thus also would be relying a lot on, firstly, sitting with a burden primarily of whether or not what they're going to do might potentially lead to some sort of damage or potentially to some sort of a disaster. And the scientific research has helped sort of like be the guiding light for them to avoid disasters and thus understand that, you know, they need another particular scientific realm to help them with avoiding disasters entirely. De Graaf Tyson's further appeal was one based on, for example, how the United States can try and reclaim a position that they held very long for. But he also conceded that when he, because De Graaf Tyson is now in his 60s, he's 68 or 67, he's in his 60s, and he said when he was on university for his postgraduate qualifications, which was in the 70s, he said a lot of his friends at the time on university who were doing, you know, a lot of particular postgraduate qualifications and work came from countries who did not have the potential to provide these particular, you know, this particular extended learning capabilities, which is also something specifically that here the NCRST had locally shown and highlighted here in Namibia, primarily being the concern that Namibia sends. We have these partnership agreements with other countries. We send these, we send our Namibia, our brightest Namibians to these various programs across the world. You know, that, that, there was one stage, before NASFAF, obviously, or actually before 2025 itself. There was a whole bunch of, like, at one stage, NASFAF programs that, but you needed to have an advanced degree and you could go and study, for example, in Japan. And it was various scientific, scientific or engineering based courses. Another scenario was obviously also the opportunity of accessing other countries and their particular advanced, you know, advanced learning and research programs, whether it be through NASFAF or any other particular agency, for example, like the local universities. And it was one of these scenarios primarily in terms of advancing research, and specifically if it was in science, to advance scientific research for countries like Namibia, developing countries like Namibia. Now, besides the knowledge, which you can concede primarily will be left and owned by the university that, or the institution that the Namibian goes and studies with there abroad, because you have to concede at least you're being trained over there, given access to the knowledge and the training over there in that other country. So it's just that the particular report or the thesis or whatever, the dissertation that you're writing, is owned by that institution because you will be aligned to them. De Graaf Tyson cited that Namibia is part of a cluster of countries specifically. He didn't mention Namibia specifically, but he mentioned that at that stage, in the 70s, there was a first generation of, for example, he uses Chinese scientists, a first generation of Chinese scientists that were sent to America to these universities, learned science, and decided to either settle down in America or, you know, move back to China. Then a second generation of scientific students were sent over to America, learned the science and got their particular qualifications, and then went back. And then the third generation of Chinese scientists are no longer coming to the United States to learn new knowledge. Now they're being trained by that generation that was taught in the United States back at home, which technically shows the particular capacity development journey that, for example, countries like Namibia has been pursuing. We've been pursuing the same and similar path. Now, this obviously cites primarily the particular benefits, obviously, of, you know, sending, you know, your brightest minds to other countries across the world. They go gather the knowledge and the information, and they come back with the hope. You hope they come back, you know. As Namibia, you hope the people come back. In some cases, they do. In some cases, they don't. But you know, it's always that particular gamble that you've got to take, that, you know, those Namibians technically go out, they go gain that knowledge, and then they come back. The biggest concern for De Graaf Tyson has been, in the United States context, has been that cuts to scientific research that has taken place, scientific research funding specifically. And the downside is, yes, you'll have one guy that will just be, you know, scientifically researching a major problem for 10 years until they get the particular discovery or the breakthrough. One of the most famous examples have obviously been, which I technically was a little bit shocked about this example, had been, for example, what happened to Marie Curie. Marie Curie, unfortunately, you could assume she died from overexposure to uranium. But she was technically the person who discovered uranium's radiation, she and her husband. So you could assume in that scenario that primarily this is the particular condition that, cites a very dangerous discovery pathway, but nonetheless, her notes, her research, her information is known the world over in the scientific community, and they all know now, we all know now, as a broader enlightened global community about the potentials, the positives of nuclear energy and nuclear radiation, and what uranium technically means for a country's economy, and the other particular, sets of knowledge around public health, environmental well-being, and public well-being and all that, and specifically what you need to do and how you need to act in and around the particular rock itself. Now, as deGrasse Tyson is citing, that scientific research should not suffer budget cuts and the like, specifically in these advanced economies and these developed countries, he does make a core point about this scenario. Recently, Brian Cox, the UK, the world famous UK scientist who's an astrophysicist, also shares the same sentiment as deGrasse Tyson. Now, deGrasse Tyson had multiple appeals within his particular address, and he made pretty strong points, which I hope in a future Namibia, we could also basically emphasize a similar particular thing, about the ability to not cut funding for research in a broader scenario. Brian Cox in the UK earlier this year, this was back in March, just that I am sure, this was back in March, where the British government had announced nearly 70% of cuts to university departments that focus and concentrate on research in the UK. This has also led specifically to potentially programs being postponed for another year. This is obviously as the UK had decided to, on certain research, technically on research and development from universities, postpone them for another year. This technically also led to postdoctoral research and programs and projects being postponed for another year. In this particular scenario, The Guardian from the UK cited that this meant that the United Kingdom would not be graduating any postdoctoral researchers for this year, meaning postdoctoral work would not be acknowledged with a graduation this year because of budget cuts by the UK government to the universities and their research programs. Do you see the significance of such a particular impact? deGrasse Tyson obviously made an appeal in his particular platform for reclaiming innovation and research and development for the United States, but it needs to be a concerted effort because it's not just about giving a pep talk, but rather that
acknowledging the work that research has actually done. And the most famous research and development example I can give you guys was that medical example of the lady that discovered one of the COVID vaccines. Please, guys, in many cases, I see there's still this mislabeling of using the word COVID vaccine or the label of it. Because primarily, what Namibia had been exposed to, if you look at the Namibian context, we were exposed to 4 vaccines. It was the Russian one, Sputnik. There was the Chinese one, Sinovac. Then there was the Covishield, which was a AstraZeneca variant produced by India. And then there was one of the particular other guys that came from a European scenario. Yeah, 4, basically. No, there were 5. There was a 5th one. We as Namibia, we were exposed to technically 5 of these vaccines. There were 5 different vaccines. So you can't just go and say the COVID vaccine. In my scenario, I would ask you which one, because there were 5 of them that were here in Namibia. The one that I want to cite specifically, the best example of research and development, but all of them technically were about research and development, was the AstraZeneca one, which was produced by Oxford and the Swedish company, the Swedish pharmaceutical company, AstraZeneca. The lead researcher behind the vaccine itself is a woman medical scientist at the University of Oxford, who for 20 years before 2020? Yeah, for 20 years, she'd been developing and researching to find the next vaccine. For it first started with malaria, then it started with another animal kingdom virus that jumps from a specific animal to humans. And then every time when she's busy researching for this particular project that she was given funding for, somewhere halfway between her research, it has to jump over to the new one. And she kept on developing and building up this library and this particular research hub specifically of knowledge on viruses and particular microorganisms that jump from the animal kingdom to humans. You know, when you are bitten, when a human is exposed to certain things, so on and so forth. She built up such a particular massive library of research that when the COVID vaccine came along, and I read this particular article itself, you can still find it online, it was very easy for her to identify similarities between the particular virus associated to the COVID pandemic and the research that she had built up. It was very easy for her to do that. It was super easy for her to do that. Because she'd for 20 years built up so much knowledge. And when I read the story, I was like, how lucky are we to have this person? How lucky are we to have this person? This one woman and her team. We've just been researching and researching and researching and researching and research, and then they get told, hey, you know what? There's a new project we want to focus on. So please drop that research. Go and start with this one. And then she researches and researches and researches. And then she gets told halfway through that project, you know what? You know what? You know what? There's a new immediate concern somewhere in Central Africa. We want you to focus on Ebola. And she researches and researches and researches and researches. How lucky do you think we are as humanity that this woman had the patience to just continue with her work? Every time the work changes, she's not done with the previous project. She gets told, listen, here's new funding. Go focus on this. And while she's still busy researching, gathering in the information and doing the analysis and with submitting reports and all that, halfway through that, she gets told, here's a new budget. Focus on this, please, because there's immediate concern for this. Now, for now, it does bring us up to our next musical break, specifically. We'll be back right after this, dissecting some of the... There's an interesting contribution from another scientist herself, known as Elizabeth Blackburn, who is herself also a Nobelist, as she's known. And we'll be coming back in terms of what she cites primarily the scientists also provide. On that note, this is my Sunday Morning Take. We'll be back right after this short musical break. Coming back there from the extended musical break, dear listeners, Sand, you find yourself here on my Sunday morning take on your number one talk crew station. And if you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning. Do hope that you've got something warm in your hands. primarily. I only have my, you know, trusty water bottle close at hand. But nonetheless, we find ourselves particularly in a discussion where it's not primarily, as we've always done, looking at historic events that combine a whole bunch of the other particular, you know, themes that we look at in my Sunday morning take, but rather we take a look at what is potentially happening to scientific research across the world. And this coming from leading scientific sources in this particular realm. Now, just before the break, I cited the particular appeal, global appeal, as it is, because I saw it on YouTube, by Neil deGrasse Tyson, very detailed illustration primarily of a threat to new knowledge being generated just for this calendar year of 2026 from a UK scenario. And that's also citing her particular contribution will now come next right after I'm done with this sort of like, you know, summary scenario. But the understanding or the misunderstanding primarily, as it seems, of what scientists technically do or researchers technically do. Because a scientist is a researcher. Now, as I mentioned for like the UK example, the threat to UK scientific research in the UK context is, you know, has been impacted by severe budgetary cuts, up to 70% in some scenarios at some universities, which will lead to some universities in the UK not being able to technically graduate or complete certain particular postdoctoral, acknowledgements and accolades for work done on either existing or, you know, close to finishing research projects. And this technically means that for the whole of this particular academic year in the UK, there is technically not going to be any new knowledge to be published. Now, this was cited back in March of this year. Back in March, that the governmental cuts to research and scientific research projects at UK universities will see a dramatic decrease of at least, you know, all programs not being able to release new work. Potentially, for those of you that don't study, you know, this might seem like, you know what, it's not a train smash. For a country's prestige, you could technically view it as, okay, this does look bad. You know, it's not the end of the world, but it does look bad. Not having the money to technically spend on the programs we need that has to find solutions to the problems we face daily. If you're the everyday person, you would go like, you know, you would ask the same question like those inhabitants from Rundu asked my colleague, Anna Kleta, about the nuclear bill public engagements. What does it do to my life? In each realm that I'm showing you is a dominant perspective, a dominant perception. A dominant illustration of each particular realm in the country and what they think of a specific subject matter and its impact on their lives. Now, if you can't immediately see, for example, some of the direct benefits that scientific research has brought you, you know, it's not a train smash. The world will not end. Because it just probably means you just don't think about these things, you know, in that kind of a way. I, in some cases, look at what would life have been without XYZ product or XYZ particular development or XYZ particular innovation. I look at, for example, something as basic as the potential that, for example, the internet has brought versus just relying on the TV or just relying on the newspapers, primarily to give you the information that you need to understand about the world around you. It's a dramatically different scenario. Dramatically different scenario. In some cases, yes, unfortunately, the internet and the proliferation of the internet has allowed for, like in my personal case, the ability to research and read about and to be up to date with current events and affairs and developments without having to pay for a, you know, a TV license, without having to pay for a pay-per-view package, without having to invest in some of the other particular pieces of infrastructure around acquiring, you know, daily entertainment and daily knowledge and understanding, but that I actually could enhance my understanding because there was a scientist or a bunch of scientists back in the 1950s in the US who decided to develop the internet. And the internet was sponsored, and the internet development program was sponsored by the American Army, the US government. And today, and today, I'm sitting with that benefit that was developed 50 years ago, 50 or more, 50, yeah, 70 years ago. It was developed 70 years ago. I'm sitting with that benefit today. The day I can technically tell you from my overexposure to just YouTube, and YouTube is but a small part of the internet, how wonderful of a resource this particular medium is. The internet is a platform. YouTube is a product on that platform because the internet is similar to the television, which is a platform, the radio, which is a platform, and print media, which is a platform. That's the internet. And if you reason like the person that I argued with in this past week, because I literally argued with the person, maintaining my cool, obviously, and ensuring that I need to stay as adult-like as possible, is that the person's argument with me was that YouTube and TikTok, from her perspective, that they are two different platforms. Now, there's a mistake that you immediately make if you use the word platform instead of company. I kept telling her it's the same platform. She kept arguing that specifically, no, it's not. It's two different companies. Yes, it's two different companies, but it's the same platform. It's the exact same products that they're selling because it's built from the exact same technology, which is the internet. And for many of this particular thinking, dear listeners, yes, not every person thinks the same. Yes, not all of us have the same thinking and knowledge exposure and thinking processes behind the decisions that we make. But there's an important thing also to note. The internet provides you with more access to more knowledge versus just relying on, for example, what I saw, what the TV used to do, is they would go and develop the documentaries to show you. But not all documentaries were to my liking, and not all particular knowledge that they shared there were things that I wanted to know about. Because my particular need was, okay, what's new? Not, now you're repeating something that I saw 3 years ago. Why am I seeing something 3 years ago? Today. So, and even then, the three particular communication platforms that I cited to you just now, who developed them? Let me also say to you something key. For example, the writing systems, the alphabets, the books, the knowledge, the research behind them. All of this came from some sort of a scientific perspective. Because you can have scientists and researchers at various levels of human society. It's not you just because there's the word scientist behind a guy or woman's name. Now you assume that person can do everything. Technically, those people are specialized in something. So you just have to align them with their speciality. Then you will get them, you will get the optimum level of particular research from them. You can't go and assume that because this person is a scientist in, let's say, nuclear energy, now you assume this guy can also deal with, be a scientist for the human body. No. It's two different realms. Two different scientific realms. Yes, they are part of science. But they are one of the many subcategories of science. It's, for example, like how I've seen how people believe that just because an IT guy is the IT guy in a company, now he needs to be the electrician, the engineer, the construction worker, the project planner. Homeboy is just the IT technician. He's either certified to a level or he's qualified in something in a particular advanced field of information technology. But the roles that he is being given to technically fulfill are misaligned with his particular skill sets. And this happens all across the Namibian economy. All across the Namibian economy. Literally all across the Namibian economy. I've seen this happen. And, okay, the IT professionals per se, they're not yet at a scientific level, but they do have their particular, you know, training up until their level, their respective levels. The assumption has been that in Namibia, we assume that that poor IT person, whether it be a man or woman, has to now do everything. Everything. But it's just the IT person. It is just the IT person. Now, back in March specifically, from the UK perspective, before I get across over to the other particular scientist, Elizabeth Blackburn's particular contribution. From the UK perspective of back in March, scientists warned that fields of particle theory faced existential threats after universities were informed of the savage cuts into research, specifically like in the UK context. DeGrasse Tyson obviously cited that, you know, there's this major misunderstanding that engineers are now the new scientists, but engineers are not the guys researching the new developments and the innovations. The engineers have to bring solutions. They would not have time to be also doing the research and development. Engineers get trained on the research and development that the scientists have done. And that scientific development and scientific endeavor is all about creativity, innovation, imagination, as well as also time and resources. Not to say that it is primarily a field that is just a black hole of just throwing money and resources in, but we have to be honest. In some cases, like the COVID vaccine, AstraZeneca COVID vaccine example I gave you just a little bit earlier in the show this morning, that is a prime example of such particular developments. Now, crossing over to the contribution of Elizabeth Blackburn. Now, Elizabeth Blackburn, as mentioned a little bit earlier, is a Nobelist. She's an Australian-American biochemist. In a sense, yes, a scientist as well, obviously. She co-discovered telomerase, which is an enzyme that replenishes the telomere. And if you know specifically, chemists are also crucial, scientists in their own realm. In terms of that, they help to find out the most micro of organisms and their uses and what they primarily provide. A telomere, if you did not know, and I did not know, I did read up on telomeres before, is that a telomere is a protective DNA layer around chromosomes, or at the end of a chromosome, not the whole chromosome, at the end of a chromosome. And the telomerase that I mentioned, that Elizabeth Blackburn had developed, or not developed, sorry, not developed, she discovered this as well. Telomerase is an enzyme that replenishes the telomere, the protective layer around a chromosome. She won a Nobel Prize in physiology, which is also medicine, which helped to revolutionize the understanding of the cellular aging and cancer. As mentioned many times, specifically when I explain to you, technically what is the sort of like the root characteristic of cancer. Cancer is the multiplication, but at a rapid rate, of cells, which technically are out of control against the other healthy cells in around it. So that's from my basic biology back in high school. It was explained in the textbook that we had at the time that cancer is technically mutating cells. Now, you, as a human, you are made up. You're a complex, you're an organism with a complex cellular structure. Meaning, your organs have different cells from your skin cells. Your blood has cells different from your, let's say, from your lungs. You've got a lymphatic system running throughout your body. If none of you know what a lymphatic system is technically your transport system for waste away or out of your bloodstream. So where you would see a vein, right next to that vein would be a lymph node or a lymphatic, vessel, which would then take out any particular toxins or any particular waste materials out of your blood supply into the lymph vessel, and the lymph vessel tries to then excrete it out somewhere, either through your skin or it channels it back through your digestive system, which is the two particular known means specifically of getting waste out of your body. Or it would go through your kidneys and your liver, then through your bladder, and then through your urethra, or gather in your bladder, and then through your urethra out of your body. Your digestive system is primarily connected to your rectum. I'm just speaking facts, guys. Not being crude in any manner. This is how biology is structured. So yeah, there are two ways of getting waste, three ways technically of getting waste out of your body. One is your skin. Second one is through the urethra. And the third one is technically your digestive system ending, obviously, you know, when you have to go to number twos. Yeah. So that is what Elizabeth Blackburn, specifically, had been cited in terms of, the work that she has done specifically, which has contributed to further research and understanding about cancer and cellular aging, how we get old, because we do get old. Now, what Blackburn shared technically was like a historical sort of like view on understanding the role that science has to play in finding the solutions for the future. Now, she cited, and this is, it technically sounds like an opinion piece article, but she cites him. Our planet today faces tremendous pressures, a burgeoning and aging population, accelerating climate change, polluted waters, threatened food crops, and drug-resistant diseases. And that without intervention, these particular pressures promise to inflate to catastrophes. Now, as she obviously starts with a premise there of, look at the world as you see it today. There are major problems. There are major issues. And how you deal with these issues is not primarily, potentially, just hoping that a politician somewhere is the only solution provider, but that this politician knows that when they say yes, they know that there's a scientist close at hand that has the with us or scientific team that could be leveraged on. You guys have ever heard of the enzyme that is used to eat oil when there's an oil spill, which is part of the cleaning up activities specifically around when an oil spill takes place. That particular enzyme could not have come without scientific research being discovered, because how do you clean up a severe human-made catastrophe like an oil spill? How do you clean up an oil spill? An oil spills impact fish life, meaning aquatic life, bird life in many cases, human lives meaning communities that lived close to, you know, that shoreline where an oil spill would have happened. Water sources, fresh water sources, local economies, both tourism and other impacted local economies. How would you deal with an oil spill? How many Namibians do we know that, when Namibia is trained, that could effectively deal with a catastrophe like an oil spill? Since Namibia was now pursuing this oil and gas rapid advancement, how would we deal with an oil spill? How would we? No, guys, it's a core philosophic question to ask. How would you deal with an oil spill? There's going, for example, at the end of this year, there's going to be the highly publicized sort of like nuclear response exercise that Namibia has to conduct, which I told you guys about at the end of last year specifically, and then at the start of the, you know, and part of this nuclear bill excursions and discussions that have taken place, you know, that that agency under the Ministry of Health, the nuclear authority, or Nuclear Radiation Authority, where primarily they will, well, part of the bill is obviously to try and enhance and to basically position Namibia itself to be ready technically in having all set structures and laws in place. For example, when we then start we then enter into the nuclear science of things. Because we have to ask this question, guys. Do we have the people? Do we have the scientists? Has Namibia adequately trained the scientists? Has Namibia trained these people? And these are people now that are training and studying for a long time. Many years. Many years. In Europe, their scientific research culture is one of, you should not have an 8-to-5 as a scientist. Your whole job is just doing R&D. Your job is R&D. Namibia is still in that developmental curve in terms of first the understanding. Do we have capacity to technically tell a scientist in Namibia, Namibian, you are not going to be teaching people, you are just research and developing. You are just focusing on R&D. You will bring out solutions for Namibia's climate change strategy to enhance Namibia's NDCs. You will bring out a strategy or results for how Namibia makes water from air, for example. You will bring out a strategy for Namibia to enhance the power to X potential of the green industries in the country and make it so that we could then develop our own car technology for the transport future to come. That's what a scientist does. That's the work that a scientist does. No lecturing, no teaching. And yet you can still anticipate. It's a bit of a stretch to ask of us now as Namibia as we are to technically now, you know, not first train these people and then have these people then train other people so that we can then get into that realm of basically saying now we have people that can just do R&D and while the others are teaching. Because Brian Cox, for example, is a lecturer, is a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester. He's a lecturer, he's a senior lecturer. And he does have, obviously, oversight over research programs at that university. He does have. But what I've obviously seen, for example, in the Namibian context, if you reach a certain particular advanced degree level, you get put in an administrative role. Or as leadership of an administrative role. It seems more like, which is a very selfish particular view that I'm now taking, that you are rewarded for reaching a certain particular academic level, and then you are told, okay, we will give you a high-ranking administrative role. And then you sit there asking yourself, what? Couldn't this person have been better deployed as a researcher, leading a particular research program in Namibia? Now back to Blackburn, Elizabeth Blackburn specifically. Now she says that scientists stand ready to help provide solutions, and for centuries, we've been some of the world's greatest or great problem solvers. We tackle all the critical issues of humanity with generations of accumulated knowledge behind us. aided further by technological advances and groundbreaking insights, we produce reams of valuable knowledge. Unfortunately, and there's always a caveat, we sometimes see this wealth go to waste. Personal prejudices or political agendas ignore scientific fact, which further endangers the world that we live in. Now, here's what she highlights, meaning her proposal. Her argument submission. I propose we take a different track, or a different tack. Let's initiate a unified and universal reliance on science to better protect our world and the people living in it. We should begin by emphasizing scientific education in our children and elevating scientific proficiency among our citizens. I believe we must grow knowledgeable voters, those who will continue to implement good science policy. As scientists, we strive to better explain the arduous and meticulous path that sound scientific research must follow. Few people realize how many thousands of assays must be performed. How many years of animal studies and clinical trials must be successfully completed, and how many objective reviews must be passed before a new drug can be responsibly introduced to the world. Shared information will nurture confident partnership. In addition to the essential human benefits of scientific research, we must work to convey the material value of funding such research. We must strive to show how scientific discovery drives advancements in prosperity, meaning spurring private investment, adding jobs and industries, and introducing commercialized products, all while reducing the socioeconomic burden of illness and disability, and further supporting the planet that nourishes and sustains us. Now, I'll just stop it there. I'll just park the bus right there. Primarily in what she was showing, which is technically this plea that she cited in this particular text. Now, the core thing that we've obviously been seeing, for example, if you've been paying attention to the AI developments, I don't know how many of you guys have actually paid attention to the AI developments primarily that have been happening. But the downside has been that it has now been proven specifically that what the Americans were doing is that they were going about this in the wrong way, specifically with the AI developments primarily. I.e. that they are mostly now rehiring the people that they fired. Let me say this again. They are rehiring the people that they fired. And obviously, a developer, you know, for example, in the software engineering industry, a developer is crucial specifically to ensuring that product quality is a core function. But if you then try to look at where AI and robotics are basically merged in terms of achieving the same particular productive outcome, it is a very troubling thing to hear and to read and to see when the Ford Motor Company in the United States has had to go and rehire the whole product quality engineers that they fired, basically to be replaced with their AI and robotics program, because the AI and robotics program has not been top-notch, you know, to basically borrow President Bumba and Helmut's favorite phrase, it has not been top-notch for this particular aspect. And now Ford Motor Company in the United States has turned back to the quality assurance manager engineers that they released back in last year on severance pay, and now they have to basically be rehired and to come and do the same work that they were told they were surplus to requirements for. But as we obviously look at this particular development and these particular aspects, Blackburn's appeal, the one that I still like specifically about, let's try and advance scientific learning as much as possible. Good. But you know that it's harder than it usually is. it's harder than it usually is, because primarily, as humans, we follow what we want to follow. Meaning, you have the basic right of choice to what you want to do being, you know, given or allowed to you. This particular basic right, this particular dimension of choice allows you then to decide whether or not you want to become an actor, or whether or not you want to become an athlete, or whether you want to become an artist, or whether you want to become a lawyer, or whether you want to become a historian, or this, or that, and this, and that. It all depends. Scientific education obviously would be nice for all, but it would be a question of whether all can technically understand the field or how the particular scientific education component would take place. Now, I'm not saying that, unfortunately, most particular knowledge realms of humanity are competing with each other, which they technically are if it comes to funding and budgeting and resources and human capital and, you know, and all other particular resources associated to being able to successfully and comfortably achieve targets and goals and conduct work. But it's also a dimension of primarily looking at, is there scope for this particular research? Meaning scope in the scope in the explainer that I would give you right now would be, would you be able to achieve it? Do you have the time and the freedom to achieve this? That's a question only that the particularly involved people would be able to ask. We take another musical break, dear listeners. We are close to the last quarter of this morning's particular discussion here on your number one talk radio station. This is my Sunday morning take. We will be back right after this.
It's been a while and everything's changed. I lost my vision, but I'm coming of age now. Well, at some stage, I changed my mind over a bottle of cheap wine. I'll fix myself up when the moment's right. Just not tonight. Say a prayer into my drink. I think about you more than I should. Would I fade into the solar system if I left my neighborhood? Stay now. I was looking for a real soft landing. Hey now. All I wanted was some understanding. Cause I don't wanna work the room tonight. I just wanna be by your side when it all unfolds. When it all unfolds, I know that we weren't always on the same page. Well, I guess the truth is I was bruised in the first place. From the first day. If I let down my guard. Well, I don't wanna get my hopes up. Every time I get too close, I'm trying to shake my tunnel vision. Cause I think about you more than I should. Fade into the solar system if I could. If I could. Stay now. I was looking for a real soft landing. Hey now. All I want. Some understanding. Cause I don't wanna work the room tonight. I just wanna be by your side. When it all unfolds. When it all unfolds. Say a prayer into my drink. I think about you more than I should. Would I fade into the solar system if I left my neighborhood? I think about you more than you.
Coming back there from the sounds of Keane with Put the Radio On. Before that, you had a little bit of St. Raymond with the song Soft Landing. And as we're heading into the last 20 minutes of this morning's program here on your number one talk radio station, we have obviously been looking at the particular appeal by scientists across the world, primarily about what their profession is facing and the misunderstanding about it. Now, here's the thing. Not many of us know a scientist. Not many of us have seen a scientist. Not many of us have heard what scientists actually work on and how they engage and develop the solutions that we see manifesting in our world, because in many cases these are people that are confined in many cases to education facilities and research facilities, which are usually universities and leading tertiary institutions across the world. The downside is primarily we take for granted much of the work that they have done. That is the downside. We take for granted their work. We take for granted that these are people who, you know, technically work from project to project, where they basically are able to then, you know, earn their livings from, and thus also be able to provide substantial contributions to the overall existence of humanity as we know it. Now, part of Elizabeth Blackburn's particular appeal and her proposal was that she urged her government leaders and influencers around the world to join specifically scientists in understanding the value and the unique value and contributions that science has provided and still has a role to play, primarily in everyday life. She notes that primarily the world leaders and influencers have to unite in a commitment to support their particular combined efforts and prosperity to the broad scientific research that can and will create a better world. Well, so far, I've seen direct potential results of what the science has unleashed. Specifically, realizing that green hydrogen, or the production of hydrogen itself, is a means of potentially substituting the oil and gas industry. And for example, I still believe that why Namibia is pursuing the oil and gas and allowing the green hydrogen development to take place is purely a lazy decision, because we're allowing both things to happen. But we clearly know that the one actively contributes to the detriment of overall global well-being, whereas the other one is technically the painkiller. It'll remove most, you know, transport systems from the diesel and petrol that they run on, and immediately potentially convert them into the new technologies that are available in theory, but need to be produced in order to become financially feasible or economically feasible for that reality to happen. But yet, as I said, we have to see where Namibia grows to. We have to see how Namibia grows. And how long this particular path of growth will be. Because it's not just, you know, it's not just a good thing to say Namibia is still growing the whole time. We need to know at what stage does Namibia have to stop in a developmental growth path and thus achieve a specific, you know, developed growth path. Now, currently right now, some of the broader understandings in the world right now is that there is research. Actually, I did talk about this a while back, about the first particular sort of like, no, I didn't take, no, I didn't talk about this. I actually did not talk about this, and this is a little bit, not criminal, but this is problematic. So, back in March or February, the world's first fossil fuel phase-out conference took place. It is something that was championed by the governments of the Netherlands and Colombia. And you know what they did at this particular climate change, this particular phasing out fossil fuel conference? Do you know what they did, guys? They had scientists there explain potential solutions to the people there. Scientists. They allowed scientists, not politicians, to make speeches. They allowed scientists to make speeches about possible interventions and technologies that can help achieve a better global climatic health level. Now, I was so surprised. Obviously, the person who made this particular YouTube video was just sharing knowledge, citing that he came from one of the most exciting conferences in the world. And then he had to share, and that he had to share this particular contribution. The concern was, I went and read through these documents and these relevant information sets, and I was impressed. I was really impressed. Because they weren't talking about climate change or conference of parties or, having elaborate particular gatherings every year just to be stagnating at the same spot for the past 5 years. No, this was actually a collection of countries who didn't invite the world's biggest polluters also to contribute. They technically just invited the scientists from around the world to say, hey, listen, what do you as a scientist, let's say, from Australia have to offer? What knowledge, what contribution is there? And they were allowed to talk. They were also told, no cell phones. Don't read from a PowerPoint. Just talk. Let's see. Let's hear you talk. And it is refreshing to hear such particular developments happening, where it's not a senior government official speaking on behalf of the direction, the policy direction of a government. It is actually people who have been looking at the negative and the positive of the solutions that they are researching and developing. What can it cause? What can it contribute? What can it alleviate? What it might exacerbate? And all these particular developments are specifically aimed at improving our lives. Our lives. Nothing more, nothing less. Actually, let me bring up that particular So that fossil fuel phase out conference that I mentioned to you guys. It's actually known as the, it was held in the next one will be held in Tuvalu and next year, but it is technically known as the Transition Away Conference. That is its actual name. The Transition Away Conference. And they literally wrote a report. Yes, they literally wrote a report. Oh, wow. Yes, yes, there's a report. Now, anyway, before I get excited, because I love reports. In this particular conference, they had the opportunity of generating dialogue from 14 different groups, because they had more than 1,000 stakeholders and more than 57 countries participated in this discussion. And the aspect of what was at the heart of this particular discussion was that their theme for COP30, because COP30 happened last year, this year is going to be COP31. For COP30, they decided to establish an activation group, which was titled as the Transitioning Away from Fossil Fuels in a Just, Orderly, and Equitable Manner. That was their theme, with science at its anchor. And that this group aimed to work to sustain momentum throughout this year of 2026, ensuring complementarity with the UNFCCC and other existing frameworks, and to identify areas where additional action is needed. You see, it's one of those things that a little bit earlier here on the My Sunday Morning Take, that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just have to think about the wheel in a different way, or about a different resource potentially for the wheel, or how to understand what the wheel technically resembles. Now, this particular conference that took place was held in Colombia in April, from 24 to 29 April. And it was a unique thing, man. It was a completely unique development, basically, that brought a whole completely different, because I couldn't believe, you know, usually when it comes to YouTubers, man, YouTubers and streamers, they sometimes know how to embellish. And when I say embellishment, I mean, these social media influencers, man, are the world's worst liars. In many cases, scammers. In many cases, that they're also just downright rotten individuals who know that they are basically lying to an audience. And it's one of those particular things when it comes to professionals like myself and like what we do here at Eagle FM, where we are based upon, our whole premise is based upon sharing with you factual information, not making up things, not basically assuming severe situations. You are allowed to assume to an extent, you know, in the realm of discourse and conversation. You are allowed to assume. Assumption is not a crime, because scientists also assume. And the word assumption is also a very critical label in scientific reports and in research reports. Remember this, guys. Language is a critical medium. It is. But it is always safe to cite specific terminologies. Because there was once an argument, okay, it wasn't an argument actually, because we couldn't understand why the lecturer approved the response that one of my classmates gave at this time. It was a research methodology lesson. And she asked the question, the lecturer, she asked the question directly to us, the class. And some of us, we were clearly assuming, but we didn't emphasize that we are assuming, basically to sort of like exonerate you from being negatively judged by the lecturer's particular assessment of your response, but basically in a sense of you basically use the words that are in your armory to express how to respond to the question that the lecturer had asked. So the lecturer asked this question. Bunch of us were like in the wrong. I was part of that bunch that were in the wrong because we made a direct assumption without stating our sentence. I assume this is the situation. And from this assumption, in order to answer your question, this is potentially what would happen. One lady, or one classmate, which is a lady, yes, she answered that way. Sounded very diplomatically at that moment. Sounded very, you know, trying to be politically correct in her response, obviously, to the lecturers. And the lecturer actually gave her acknowledgement of giving the appropriate response. Because she inserted in her response the word, I assume. Like I said, there is nothing wrong in an assessment of using the phrase, I assume. Because you are sure, you are telling the other party, I am busy assuming a situation. So I assume that this was there. There's also another English word that is pretty close to the word assumption or assume, known as presumption, meaning I presume. Now, presumption and assumption are technically two words that technically are the same thing, but presumption slightly differs in that you are assuming that this is a fact. You see, where the word assumption was just a broad stroke of that term, meaning you are just being broadly, your application of the word indicates that you are slightly generalizing. Slightly. Well, not generalizing. Sorry. That's also a bit off in that explanation. But you are, you know, you are being a little bit liberal in imagining a situation. But presumption technically takes the word assumption and says, these elements or these ingredients to the scenario are fact. I presume this is fact. I presume this is the reality. I presume that this is the scenario. Meaning you assume that something is fact. However, as we obviously look to science as the world for finding the solutions that we need for the particular threats, problems that the world faces, the conversation out there has still been one of what are we looking at? Now, what I am most saddened by is that a country like Namibia is pursuing predominantly enhancing the research and development realm for the science or technically or the maths-induced segments of the Namibian knowledge realm. We are not advancing research and development for the humanities realm. I call it the mathematically induced realm because primarily at the core of that science, at the core of science is maths. They deal with problem solving starting from mathematical problems. But we also need to enhance the humanities research and development. We need to, guys. Psychology specifically. Because there's a whole bunch of us that are crazy in this country. And I'm not being funny. I'm not making any jokes on anybody. Even though it might have a little bit of a tinge of comedic element to it. But we need more research. We need more research. I mean, a clear example was the gambling, the responsible gambling conference that I attended in terms of coverage and getting, you know, content from. Was when the lady representing the Ministry of Health and the lady representing the Lifeline, or was it, yeah, Project Hope, or was it Lifeline? No, what Project Hope, yes. That was the NGO's name. Those two particular professionals when I asked them a direct question specifically, when you get referred, when someone with a gambling, who's a gambling addict, basically, because it's a condition, when this person is referred to you, are they referred to you on the basis that it is the gambling that you know of, that you've got to deal with as this particular counselor, the psychological counselor? Or are they referred to you on the basis of other potential ailments and issues that you realize through those other issues and ailments and conditions that this person's behavior is fueled by irresponsible gambling behavior? And the lady from the Ministry of Health, who is a trained psychologist, but she didn't use in that discussion the label of doctor. She did not. She refrained from using it because she kept saying, listen, she's not yet at that level, but she is a psychologist for the Ministry of Health. She cited that, unfortunately, when people who they later on discover are sufferers of, of gambling addiction, is that they show up there with other particular ailments. So the psychologists in Namibia are responding directly to certain ailments that they see here. But they're also not being given the full scope of information by the victim or by the sufferer or by the particular person that is obviously the suffering from this affliction, this mental affliction or this behavioral affliction, is a scenario that they have to go through layers and layers and layers of this particular person sitting in front of them in order to properly diagnose the actual cause. The actual cause. The actual cause for why that person is sitting in front of you. Now, just before we end, dear listeners, on that particular note, we'll quickly be taking a short break and we'll be coming back right after this.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
thought I knew them all by name, but they started looking much the same, and it's no surprise that I don't want to listen too much. How can I give up on all the days I know I've won? There's nothing but rainbows. I believe in the shadows behind me. Thought I might be dropping out, but now I'm gonna work it out. I'm gonna work with me. I'm running like an Appaloosa, then I'm rolling like a rusty ship on a stormy sea. You know the people are saying strange things. Tied to the head, cause I know you think the face is gone. I don't want to listen too much. I'm not gonna give up on all the days I know I've won. There's nothing but blue sky. There's nothing but blue sky. Nothing's gonna stop me now. I'm skimming like a skipping stone on a silver lake. Perfect happy clown, you gotta make a mistake. And people are saying strange things, and I don't wanna listen too much, yeah. Nothing but blue sky. Blue sky. How can I tell you I know this won't be the last song? I don't wanna listen too much. Not gonna give up on all the days that I know I won. That's where I'm going. Cause there's nothing, nothing but blue.
Come back there from the sounds of Jamaica once again. Before that was a little bit of New Guinea with the song Marekia. And it does bring us up to the end of this morning session here in your number one talk radio station here of my Sunday morning take. Primarily as we've looked at the particular sort of like worrying trend. It's not to say that it's not going to be pursued again, but it's just in terms of continuing good work that is meant for the improvement or the betterment of humanity as a whole. Now, on that note, dear listeners, this has been my Sunday morning take on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM, and wishing you the rest of your Sunday, wishing you a good Sunday for the rest of the day, and obviously, stay tuned for the rest of the programming in our company. We'll be back with the rest of your Sunday morning programming after this break.